Welcome to Healthcare Crossroads, a podcast showcasing the connections we make in healthcare data, compliance, and patient care. We are at a crossroads in healthcare. Let's make an impact by bringing together physicians, nurses, healthcare information management professionals, and legal experts in healthcare. Everyone in healthcare intersects. Let's find out how. This is Healthcare Crossroads. Here is your host, Jennifer McNamara.
Welcome to the Healthcare Crossroads. We are so excited to have you all here. This is a podcast that we're starting just to talk about healthcare data, compliance, patient care, where we all intersect. We all intersect in healthcare. And so I am here, episode one of this podcast. I am your host, Jennifer McNamara. I am the Director of Education and Coding at OncoSpark. And today I have a very special guest, Betty Hovey, one of my favorite people in the industry. Welcome to the show, Betty.
Oh, thanks, Jennifer. I am so happy to be here on the kickoff new rebranding podcast. It's exciting.
It is very exciting for all of us, thinking about where we've come, how far we've come, not only just in our careers, but even just since 2020, right?
Yes, 2020. I'm so glad that this is way over. Let's forget about it.
Yeah, I think when that year started, I was feeling, you know, very excited about what was going to happen. It was 2020, you know, it was like a big deal. I had vacations planned. I had all kinds of things planned, and I pivoted like most of us did in the industry. We pivoted with everything. I started down this road of podcasting in 2020. I started down the road of virtual education. That's, of course, how we met, right? We met through this evolving healthcare landscape, didn't we? And, you know, I'll have listeners that have listened to the episode that we had previously together, but I have some new listener. We have some new listeners since then. So if you could, of course, just tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, how long you've been in healthcare, what brought you to your current role in healthcare, and what you're up to.
Sure. Well, I have been in healthcare for over three decades. Actually, I hit 35 years this year. So, you know, but I was 12 when I started, you know, child labor, the whole, so, you know, but it's all I've ever done since I've been a grown up, you know, has been in healthcare. I love it. I started out as an x-ray tech and learned that, you know, the touchy-feely stuff wasn't, you know, so much my bag. Worked at a hospital that was not officially the county hospital, but was kind of the county hospital, you know, so we just got everything. We had the prisoners from Stateville, which was the largest prison in the country at the time. So we would get some lovely individuals that would come in that we would have to, you know, work on, had to work on some dead bodies. And, you know, so I was just like, yeah, no, it's a bit too much, you know? I went to the health system. I was just like, I don't want to do this. And so they said, well, oh, we have a great job for you. You have a medical background and, you know, terminology. And so they set me in a room for 2 weeks with the CPT and ICD-9, because that's what we were on back then, and a HCPCS book. And so I sat in there. I came in every day. I sit in this room all by myself. I'm looking at these books and I'm like, okay, you know. And then at the end of 2 weeks, they came in, they took me to my desk and said, okay, your training's done, get to work. And I was like, oh, well, okay. So back then, you know, in the 80s, we were, you know, we didn't have, there weren't really a lot. We didn't have a name for what we did. You know, it wasn't really considered a profession like it is today. So we would look at things and just be calling each other to try to say, well, what do you do with this? And how do you do with that? And, you know, I was pretty good at CPT because as an x-ray tech, you know, you're all about body parts, you know, and so I could find things in CPT. But ICD-9, I hated it because you look at a body part and it would say C condition. And I just used to drive me crazy. But back then, if I couldn't figure out an ICD-9 code, we could actually send a claim with no ICD-9 code and they would pay it because you didn't have to have one. Now, of course, we do, you know, so we have to show medical necessity and all that. But going through that really kind of spurred in my head, you know, if I'm having these kind of troubles, I can't be the only one. And I used to get calls from people from other clinics for the same stuff. Like, where did you find that before? And, you know, and so we'd make our little job aids because, you know, I don't like calling them cheat sheets. So I, you know, we'd have our job aids that we'd pass around. And it led me into the educational part of things. And you know, I got into AAPC. And I said, I took my exam again back in the early 80s. And I am such a longtime member that my membership number has like 40 in front of it. I mean, that's how far back I got my membership. And, you know, from there, just started to do education and got more into, you know, the auditing part and things, and just expanded, had my company started, and, you know, just moved into the auditing and education side of it, because that's really where my passion kind of comes in when I'm working with the physicians. I shadow physicians. I love shadowing physicians. You know, going into the patient rooms with them and kind of watching what they're doing. And then we discuss it after they get out of the room at, you know, okay, what level did you think that was? And, you know, let me see your documentation. And, you know, you get them right then. And so it sticks in their heads better, you know? And they love it. They love having you there to, oh, and what about this? And, you know, what if I said that? And, I just love that interaction. And same with the staff and the coders and the auditors. So, that's really what excites me about doing these things.
For instance, ask a question. Why do we audit, Betty? Why is this an important thing for us to do?
Well, I always tell people when we talk about this is that you want to do it yourself before somebody else does it to you. So, you know, you want to make sure you're looking at your records, looking at your documentation, making sure that your physicians and other providers' documentation is where it needs to be to support the services being billed, because the audits coming from the payors is not going away. It's just getting more and more and more. So better you know and fix it before they find it, because they'll find it.
Yes, they will. Oh my goodness. And we've had, you know, other collaborations with other auditors out there. You know, we all watch the Chuckleheads podcast, and we watch this weekly podcast that Sean Weiss has with Christine Hall and Terry Fletcher and others, where they talk about these audits and these crazy things that they're discovering with these providers and, you know, clinics and facilities getting in trouble over the place for these, to me, unnecessary things.
Yeah.
Very unnecessary. But we see that, we understand the reason why you audit. Now, you have a compliance plan. You know you have to have some kind of system in place where you're checking accuracy and consistency of data. And then, of course, whether it's internal or external, I think a lot of people miss the external part, which is what we are, right? You and I are external auditors. So why are external auditors just as important as internal? And then another follow-up question, do you need to have internal can you have an external audit without doing internal audits? What is the purpose of each of those?
Yeah, I think the misnomer or the mistaken idea is when the government suggests you do internal audits, that people, practices sometimes think internal means their own employees, you know, but, and there's nothing wrong with that. A lot of times you can have internal checks and audits to kind of spot check and target certain things to help a physician or provider that's having an issue. But having an external audit, someone from outside come in and do it, I think gives that layer of, you know, where the internal person, in fact, on the Sean's broadcast yesterday that you were talking about, or Monday, that you're talking about with Terry and Christine and those guys, I had made a comment that he read that I went into a practice that had gotten, they were in a little bit of trouble. And when I looked and they said, but, you know, all of our audits have been great. We don't understand why these payors are now asking for all this money back. And I said, okay. I said, well, who was doing your audits? And they said, well, our coder was doing them. And I said, well, do you mean the coder that does your coding is auditing her coding? And they were like, well, yeah. And I was like, well, do you not see an issue with that? You know, so she said she was great, you know, but the pay orders beg to differ, you know, so, and the other bad thing was when this started to happen, she left. And so now they were like without anybody. And so I said, well, you know, so you need to have, somebody that's not got skin in the game, who's not worried about their job, who's not worried about telling the physicians or providers, hey, maybe you're not doing this so good. And I'm not saying that all employees that do these things would do that, but, you know, some people that's got to kind of get in their head maybe a little bit, you know, and they know their doctors. And so sometimes they'll look at a record. How many times have you seen this, you know, where, you know, you're in there and they say, well, I know that's what they mean. Okay, well, you know that's what they mean, but an outside auditor is not going to give that deference to them. It's got to state it. And so sometimes the internal people kind of give a little bit more credit than an outside auditor would, that would kind of say, hey, no, you really need to be clear in your documentation on this, because while you know what you mean, somebody else might not, that's from the outside. And so it really needs to stand and give that information. So I think it's important to have that, you know, nonpartisan kind of third party looking at things, you know, to make sure that you're on the right thing. And then you really have an external auditor that is usually, not always, but usually more experienced than your internal people. They've, you know, because this is what we do, you know, and that's, we have like that broader base of knowledge, and we've seen like, oh, I've seen this with my other clients, or I've had seen this from one of the payors where they're starting to look at these things now. So you can give that practice that kind of perspective of that more broader base things that their internal person might not be seeing. So that's why I think it's really important to get that. And it stands up better, I think, if a payor is coming in and you can say, hey, we've had an external auditor look at these things, and this is what their recommendations are. Sorry, there's a plane going overhead. Wow. Okay, that sounded close. Could you hear that?
I could. Yeah, it's crazy. Well, yeah, it happens.
So, I think it kind of stands up a little bit better with the payor to say it was an outside, you know, expert that we had look at these things, and they're agreeing with, you know, what we've been doing, or, you know, we're getting some outside education to help us, or, you know, whatever that case may be. I just think it's really good to have that nonpartisan third party look in at things.
Absolutely. And I know we had planned to talk about certain types of audits because organizations need to know about these different types of audits. Most of them do know what their data hopefully is telling them, but that's the purpose of an audit, right? Is to really discover what your data is telling you, because data doesn't lie. Numbers don't lie, as we know. So let's talk about the different ones: random, targeted, and then retrospective and prospective. Go ahead and give me a little bit about these different ones from your perspective, as to why we do these different types.
Well, I think the kind of audit you're going to do, and that's the other good thing, you know, you can do different kind of ones internally and then have different kind of ones externally. So you can kind of spread and get more things, you know, hit more bases. But with the retrospective audits, you're looking for things that have already been paid. So you can get a broader base and look at more data and have more time because it's already been paid. Whereas with the prospective audits, you're doing them before they go out, and which in one way is really good because you're catching anything that may be an error before it goes out. So you're getting a clean claim that goes out. But the problem with doing the prospective audits is that if it's a large facility or a large practice that has a lot of physicians, you can't hold their claims up for that long. You know, so it really gets to be where it's not something that can be done on a larger scale basis. You can't check every single encounter that the physicians do if you have 40 physicians or even 10 physicians, 5 physicians in a practice. It's just too hard. But it can, you know, it can help with spot checking different things And if you're looking for targeted things, let's say, well, we're going to prospectively look at level fives. So any level five, before it goes out, we're going to have the coder take a look at it, you know, or modifier 25, you know, before those go out, we're going to have somebody take a look at them and make sure that it looks okay. You know, so for prospective, it's kind of good to do for things like that. Retrospective, as I said, you can do them random where when I do a baseline audit, I like to try to do for a new practice, or they've got a new physician coming on or a new provider and they want a baseline on them. You can kind of just take random things just to kind of get pieces of and see if you find anything. You can do them where they're targeted to, like I was just mentioning, like let's look at fours and fives, or let's look at new patients. Let's look at, you know, specific procedures and things. And then you can gather data from whatever your time frame is, you know, and say, okay, we're going to go from the last 3 months. You know, I don't recommend going back a year. You're asking for trouble for one, I think, if something comes up. You know, the guidelines and what payers are doing and all those things change so much that going that far back is not going to benefit you. So usually I try to do like a 3 month or quarter, you know, I don't really like to go further than that. And then you can say, okay, do we want to do this random? Are we looking just for E&M? Do we want E&Ms and minor procedures? Do we, you know, and then what I like to do is I have my clients run a CPT frequency report. So they run it by each physician and provider and see, okay, what are the main things they're doing? And then we say, okay, well, then that's what we're going to do the audits on. Now we can pull a random odd thing if they have a question on it, but you might as well spend the time on the things that they do most. That's what's going to benefit them the most. So when you're looking at doing them, so I kind of do a random targeted, if that makes sense, you know, when I look at things. Now, I also use RAT stats when I do them. RAT stats is a government software, and anybody listening can get that. You can just put in RAT stats and Google it. I love when you put it up and you download it, it's got that rat. It actually has a big rat on the icon.
So funny.
But what it does is it allows you to put in however many things you're looking at. Like I've got, you know, from the last 3 months, this provider has, you know, 800 visits or 800 encounters, and I want to do, you know, 10%, or I want to do this, and then it randomly chooses numbers for you. And that's what the government uses. So if you're using the same stuff they are, then, you know, if again, you get something from a payor, you can say, we used RAT stats to pull this. So it's truly random and it will be accepted, you know, so that's the good thing. And then I just start pulling from there. Depending on my clients, some of them, I will go into their systems, you know, I'll dial right in so we don't have to be sending records or do any of that mess anymore. Some of them don't like that, you know, so they will, you know, gather the records and then send them electronically. Some of them do still prefer the old route of sending them, you know, hard copy and paper, and that's fine. So, you know, anyway, as long as you've got the whole record, that's the thing. When you do them and they send you the paper charts and they pull it, they may be missing certain things that, you know, you may need. So it kind of drags the process out a little bit longer. But that's kind of how the process runs, or how I do it when I'm doing the processes for my clients and the different types that we look at. So I just kind of, you know, have a phone call with the clients, see what they're actually needing, you know, and then talk about how many records, because you have that whole conversation, right? that you know, it's like how many charts are enough, you know, and sometimes they want the five, you know, that seems to be like a number that people are, you know, oh, well, five's good enough. And if you have a lot of providers, a lot of physicians, you know, five may be, you know, what's workable for them. But I always tell them, you know, well, just consider though, with five charts, if you have one that's not correct, your percentage is not going to be meeting that 95 to 98% that the government says you should have, you know, so you're immediately looking at, you know, depending on how your compliance plan is laid out, looking at maybe some issues, you know? So I try to get at least 10 because it does give me a good idea sometimes of what I'm looking at. And with the way that guidelines are set now, at least for office visits, I know next year it'll be all of them. You really can get a good idea off of 10 records about, you know, where their pain points are for things and where you need to give them education. For new physicians and providers, I like to do 20, you know, because then it gives me a bigger thing to say, okay, well, they're doing okay here, or here's where we need to do a little education and kind of get them on the right track and, you know, stuff like that. So that's kind of, how I look at it and the different kinds of audits, you know, that we perform.
Wonderful. And I do have a question from Miss Annette Bush on LinkedIn. The LinkedIn feeds are not coming through here for us, but I wanted to pull this for us so we can chat a little bit with our audience. What's the best resource to know what payers are auditing?
Oh, well, there's all kinds of resources that you can look at. Most of us, and I don't know, Jennifer, if you use some different things, but a lot of us will go off of the OIG work plan is a good place to look and see, because now they update that every month. There's always new things coming on there. So you can see what the government is looking at, what the Office of Inspector General is telling CMS, hey, y'all need to pay attention to this. The CERT reports, the comprehensive error rate testing reports, those will come out and say, hey, you know, the payer should not be paying these things because we're finding documentation issues. Again, it gives, you know, Medicare, oh, then maybe we need to go look at these, you know. So if you're doing a heavy Medicare-based population or your payers follow Medicare guidelines, you know, looking on what CMS is looking at will help you in what you're looking at. Also, they have the CBRs, the comparative billing reports that will come out, and they do those every month. Every month you can go and look and see what the current CBR is that they've put out. And what those are is those are notices that get sent out to whatever they're focusing on for the month in case you're an outlier. So they'll send you a little letter and say, you know, you don't have to do anything. And we're not saying you're getting audited, but we just want to tell you, just so you know, you do a lot more of these than anybody else does. So, you know, it's kind of to let you know that it's something you should check out. So if you get a CBR, then you want to make sure that you do an audit on that specific thing and see why you're an outlier. There may be a good reason you're an outlier. Maybe you're the only specialist in the geographic area you're in that does this type of thing. And so by nature, your patients are going to be having more of these types of services or be higher level. So there may be a good reason for it. And if there is, great, then you don't have to worry. But if you get one of those letters, make sure you're taking a look at it. You know, I've been in offices where I had a physician, well, yeah, I got this letter and it said, you know, I was using the modifier 25 a lot and blah. And I said, well, where is that letter? Oh, I threw it out. I'm like, please don't do that. You know, it's, you know, so anytime you get a letter from a payor, you know, you want to make sure you go through it and that it gets to the right people. Or, you know, you get the take back requests, you know, because that's what's coming next. If you're ignoring these things, then they're going to want something back, or they're going to start asking you for records, or they're going to put you on prepayment review, you know, but those are some of the places I would say, you know, you want to go to kind of see what they're taking a look at.
Agreed. Now, going to just jump right in because you did mention modifier 25. And my next question was audit risks. And I've talked on Blue in the Face. A lot of us have talked to our Blue in the Face since 2005, the OIG came out with their report on modifier 25. It's not getting any better. Same with the modifier 59, not getting any better.
Yep.
I did a webinar recently, and we had 600 people on this webinar that wanted to attend this webinar about Modifier 25. Because it's not just, you know, the physicians want to know, but also there's just so much confusion about it. And every specialty is different, right? With how you would interpret that. And every documentation stands alone. And we have to understand, first and foremost, you're asking for more money when you append a 25 modifier. Yeah. Do you think the insurance company is just going to shell it out without looking or making sure that they're paying for it appropriately? 59, you're asking for more money because you're asking them to pay for something that is normally bundled into the other procedure you're doing. And now you're asking them to unbundle it and pay you more. And so again, they're going to ask why, and they're going to want to make sure that you have followed the guidelines. I mean, business 101, just going back to it, any business that, you know, you have a service with, they're not going to pay you money until they confirm the service was performed. Now, in healthcare, you know, there are times where you submit a claim, it gets paid, no one questions it at that point in time. But what happens later, right? So, Betty, give me some insight in here. What are you seeing? And just an overall perspective of these modifiers, what are you seeing?
Yeah, Modifier 25 is definitely on the increase as far as reviews by payors. It was on the OIG work plan for dermatology specifically. They called dermatology out, you know, and said that they were looking at it. And there are certain specialties, and dermatology happens to be one of them, where, you know, you get a patient that comes in a lot of times for derm. A patient will come in and they're coming in because they have a lesion on their arm. And then they get in there and say, oh, well, I also have this and I have this. And they want everything done today because they don't want to come back. They just want to come once a year, have you do everything under the sun that you can find on them and, you know, destroy it or shave it off or what. They just want it all done today. So you have a lot of cases where, you know, they do use Modifier 25 a lot. And like I said, as long as the documentation supports it, then I always tell my clients, hey, you deserve that money. You get the money, but you have to make sure your documentation supports it. And the whole thing with Modifier 25, as you were saying, Jennifer, is that it's that significant separately identifiable, you know, and you have to remember that when you're looking at it, you know, if you have the two different diagnoses, you know, you're kind of, you know, those are kind of no brainers with, you know, they came in and I had this done to them, but they said, oh, by the way, you know, or when I examined them, I said, hey, what's that? And then we got into this separate discussion, you know, it's in your documentation though. They have to make sure that those, oh, by the ways, you document that. And while the patient presented for this, while they were here, they also stated, you know, and then show that separate work that you did on it, you know, and if you, you know, just think about that, you know, it's separately identifiable. So what I do when I'm taking a look at this is I say, okay, every E&M or every procedure code has a little bit of E&M bundled into it because they know that no physician will or should, you know, just walk in and say, give me your arm and just start, you know, shaving stuff off. You know, they're going to ask you, you know, is it bigger? How has it changed? Let me take a look at it. They're going to talk to you and then explain what they're doing. And then they're going to do it. Well, that's E&M, right? That's part of that procedure. You don't get paid separately for that. It's part of it. So in order to get paid separately for an E&M, you have to go over and above that. So when I look at documentation, I look to see, okay, this is part of that procedure, talking to them about that lesion on their arm, you know, the examination of that lesion on their arm, all of that stuff gets pulled down into the procedure. And then I look for what's left, you know, and if there's not enough left in the note to support an E&M, then, you know, they don't get it, you know, so, that's kind of, I think the hard part is that people forget that part of detracting away the portion of the E&M that belongs down in the procedure. Because yes, there is an E&M there, but what's the E&M for? And then especially if they're scheduled for the procedure, I see this a lot. patient presents for lesion removal or for whatever the minor procedure is. And then you talk about it. So it right off the bat, it's saying they're here for the procedure. They're not here for evaluation. If they present for a procedure and all you do is that procedure, that E&M portion that you're talking to them about it is definitely bundled into that procedure, and you do not get a separately reported E&M.
Agreed. Now, you mentioned minor procedures. Now, in my world, orthopedics, and I'm also a consultant for ophthalmology, we do injections, right? So it's always been a huge issue, an audit risk with these injections, and not just necessarily the modified 25 issue. It's really just in general, the medical necessity of things. And it's, you know, are all the pieces needed? Do you have all the pieces needed documented to support this injection? And it's the units, it's having the NDC number, it's knowing the payer requirements and coverage guidelines. And all these pieces go into it, which is why I think a lot of providers or facilities just don't have a good understanding of these things. And so they have all the staff, right? And they're all getting it wrong, unfortunately, because they weren't trained. And then you're paying all this staff. You're not getting reimbursed to cover those costs. And this is why we're in the problems we're in right now. Because you have all these staff members doing these jobs that they're not trained to do. And so then you're shelling this money out to this job that's not bringing in the money. So that's why we really push on. So we push education. Do you find often that when you do these audits, that you have a clear look at where the education needs to be now? Is that an important piece to the audits?
Definitely. I always, when I do audits, excuse me, and I contract with physician practices, that's part of the audit. You know, the audit always has to come with a report and findings and, you know, do the follow-up calls and then set up education as necessary, because it doesn't do any good to keep telling somebody they're doing something wrong without telling them how to fix it. You know, you definitely have to educate. And the education, as you were saying, is not just always for the physician or provider. It does stretch out to their staff, you know, because in some practices, the physicians choose their E&M levels, maybe, but they don't choose all of the codes. And there's coders that are in the office or someone in that role, you know, that looks over things that maybe, you know, doesn't understand all the things they're looking at or doesn't have what they say, you know, well, I don't have time to go to the payer sites and look for this or look for that, you know, because there's so many, they're doing six jobs, you know, at once. And so they need help with those kind of things to say, you know. So when I do my audit findings, in every audit I do, I give an executive kind of report where it's kind of like the highlighted thing. And then I give the detailed report. And in the detailed report, I have a comments column. And it's in there where I'll put, you know, according to the CPT manual or according to the payer for this claim, you know, in their provider manual, it says on page 4 that, you know, you can't do this, you know, because that's one thing when I talk to the staff and I'll say, well, you know, what does your policy say? What does their policy say on this? Or what does your compliance plan say about this? Or your internal policies? They're like, I don't know. And I don't, you know, they don't go to the sites and use those, which is another good reason to look at external auditors too, is because of, you know, that factor. We put that extra time in that maybe an internal staff member might not have the time to do. But there's a lot of really good staff that, if they're given the education, would be able to run with the stuff. Absolutely. But, you know, they're on the job learning, and there's not time to do it, or the person that was there is gone, so they're coming in with nobody to help them. And it's just like, oh, well, yeah, you can figure it out. You know, back in the day, we'd have people that, you know, you're filing charts one day, the next day they're like, oh, yeah, you can, you know, you can do the coding. Here you go. And it really wasn't a big thought process because they didn't pay attention to it. And now they're getting that's the financials of the practice. You know, if you don't have somebody that knows what they're doing in that position, you're not going to be able to keep your doors open.
And we're seeing the results of that since 2020, even before, but it's come to a head right now. We see a lot of the problems here, staffing shortages, and going back to just in general, looking at coverage guidelines. I want to talk about this for just a second, because you work in plastics like I do, and you've had this experience. And I always preach this about coverage guidelines, because you can get a procedure code covered and you bill that procedure code. That's great. You coded it correctly, right? But you didn't look at your commercial carrier. Blue Cross Blue Shield, for instance, doesn't cover that product. And so I'm talking about in plastics, we have these grafts that the providers put on, you know, on a patient during a breast procedure, for instance. And the 157 code comes to mind. It's covered. And it's a billable code. Great. You coded it. But you didn't look that the product they were using is not covered by the policy, and now you're not getting paid. Even though you chose the correct code, you got it authorized, no money's coming in. Yep. And it also affects your facility, right? Your ASC, who also can't get that paid. So again, these are conversations I've had when I'm auditing and I'm discovering this, and our staff is discovering this with the providers. And we have to make our recommendations. At the end of the day, it's their responsibility to make those changes.
Yes.
So those are the things that I like to point out, because it's not just about the codes. It's not just about the authorization. It's about the coverage. Yes. And all those pieces go together. So you have to have somebody, at least one person, who's checking those things. Maybe it's the same person doing your coding. I say most offices will do well with having a biller and a coder, even if they're not certified, at least someone who knows what they're doing in that way.
Agreed.
Maybe you can't afford two people, but you have one person. Maybe you're a small office that you just need one person. Yeah. Even if you're a big office, do you need 10 coders? For me personally, I worked with 10 providers on my own. Personally, I had 10 providers. I did all their authorizations. I coded, I billed all for all of them.
You were a busy girl.
I was. But I got it done, and I felt like it was efficient. But I think I was properly trained too. And I definitely knew where to go for the answers. So I encourage practices that are listening, office managers, even coders, thinking about your role. Don't just go into it saying, I'm just going to code all day. I'm just going to put codes in the computer. It's not what all you do. Your goal is to get your provider paid. And that involves more than just entering a code in a computer. It's pretty important job.
Yes. And not just getting paid, it's keeping paid. Right.
Oh, yes. That's what audits are for, right?
You get paid for anything. You know, it's keeping that money. You know, will it stand up to somebody looking at it? And that's also what they have to be thinking about, because that brings in that stuff about, you know, using those products and doing things. You know, you can do anything. You can bill for anything. But, you know, it's making sure that you're safeguarding that money in the future. So you're not, because when they come to take it back, they're not going to just want that money back. They're going to want it, and they're going to want interest. And, you know, then you can get into damages and fines and all that stuff to where it's just, it's not worth it. You know, due diligence up front, you know, pays in dividends on the back end.
100%. And we're seeing the results of that right now. You know, they called 2022 the year of the audit. We've done a lot of audits, not only on the oncology side, but, you know, other types of clinics and specialties. In my history, of course, I've done orthopedics, I've done ophthalmology in the past, and those are the types of specialties I thrive on. I love surgery personally. Some people enjoy other types of services where they're audited very differently. And that's the other thing too, is that when you're looking at a certain service line, you know that those procedures are audited a certain way. So in oncology, you have your infusion, radiation oncology, even surgical onc as well. But in orthopedics or a surgical practice, you're looking at different things. I remember, you know, when I did orthopedics for the hospital and I was auditing internally, there were so many indications that the coders were just looking at that procedure description and they were not reading the op note paragraph. It was obvious, because one point he said he did a debridement to the bone. There was no evidence of that in the body of the note. I can't give you a 1-1-0-1-2-1-2 if you didn't tell me the bone was involved, right? So those are the things that we catch. And it's a matter of just talking to the provider. You know, they may have done it, but that communication from their brain to the paper or to the EMR did not happen for some reason.
Okay, well, you call it this, but that's not what CPTs call it, you know, so you get that differentiation between the fact of, you know, their kind of verbiage and what it falls under, and it just doesn't match up. I've had those conversations with physicians before that, yeah, well, that's not what they call it in CPT, or that's not where it works out to, you know, so when you're doing the op reports, you have to read the whole operative report, you know, because there's other things maybe that were added on that, again, because that's not where the physician was thinking he was going. And a lot of surgeons will dictate those first portions before, you know, they've done the surgery, and then they come back and do the actual surgical report, and it goes, you know, down a different pathway, but they never go back up to the header and change what that was supposed to be or the additional things they did. So a lot of times in op reports, I'll find things that, well, you did this too, and, you know, you can report it and get paid for it. But if they're coding out of that header, they never see it.
Exactly. And it happens, you know, and they're always asking you, we're looking for missed opportunities. Telling you what, those missed opportunities are there in the op note, but if your coders and billers aren't trained to properly code from the body of the op note, they are missing those. If they're the ones coding them. You know, I would have my orthopedic surgeon, this is before EMRs, this is when I worked before the EMRs, hand you a piece of paper with the code on it. I had to go and try to get the report. They fax it to us at that point. They fax all the op notes for the day to our office. Yep. I'd have to find the op note and look for it, because my job was to make sure we didn't just code the knee replacement. Was there an additional service? Now, most of the time, that's all bundled, but I had to make sure that there wasn't anything that we could report separately. These are all things to keep in mind, that you could be losing money, not because of the insurance issues, not because the insurance denied something. You just didn't code it correctly, and you're missing revenue because of that. You miss an opportunity here that is billable. And there's so many of those that exist that I think if practices really had auditors come in and identify those things, train their coders, provide ongoing education, then providers can still see their patients, focus on that, and the coders can feel more empowered and more educated, so they can not miss those opportunities. And then you can increase your revenue that you wouldn't have increased normally without that review.
Definitely. Yeah, you're not trying, and that's the other thing with doing the audits, you know, the external audits. We're not trying to replace your staff.
No.
You know, we're not trying to take we're there to take a look at your stuff as snapshot. They're there daily looking at the day-to-day stuff. So the more educated that they are, and the more things that you can show them, here's the things you want to look for, you know, the better they can help on an ongoing daily basis, to where that stays that steady stream or that increased stream of catching those things that weren't being caught before.
Absolutely, Betty. Well, this has been fabulous. I'm very excited that we got to do this here today and have all of these discussions about auditing, internal, external, all the different types and why they're so important. And later this month, we'll have a next episode. I'll be joined by one of my colleagues, Manish Jain of OncoSpark, and we're going to talk about the prior authorization dilemma that we find ourselves in and how it relates to other areas of auditing and coding and all of these things. So thank you, Betty, for joining us for Healthcare Crossroads. And we hope to, of course, have you on the show again. And of course, we'll collaborate in the future. And I want to thank our audience for joining in for this episode 1 of season 1 of Healthcare Crossroads. Thank you. And until next time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us this week on Healthcare Crossroads. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, so you'll never miss a show. Thank you to our sponsors at OncoSpark. OncoSpark is a technology-enabled revenue cycle management company. They help you effectively manage claims data with technology solutions. Check out their website to learn more at www.oncospark.com. Thank you, OncoSpark.